It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, mental health first aid.
First, the business of flu shots. It seems that everywhere you go this year, drugstores, supermarkets, even stores like Costco, somebody's trying to sell you a flu vaccination. Customers can pop in any time for an injection and even get discounts or gift cards as a reward for getting the shot. But getting the vaccine at a pharmacy might not be right for everybody. Jenny Gold of our partner Kaiser Health News has more.
I'm standing in front of the Walgreens in Springfield, Virginia. And in front of the store, there is a giant sign that reads, "Flu shots. Walk in anytime."
Welcome to my pharmacy. Thank you guys for coming in.
Pharmacy manager Scott Gershman is a round-faced man in his 30s with wireless glasses and a warm smile. For most of his 10 years at Walgreens, he's been behind the counter, filling prescriptions and giving advice. But 3 years ago, drugstores began training pharmacists like Gershman to give customers vaccines, too. Today, he's one of 150,000 pharmacists across the country certified to vaccinate customers. That's nearly four times the number that could do it in 2007. Some pharmacies even offer the shots 24 hours a day.
If you decided at 4 o'clock in the morning you wanted to go out and had nothing better to do than get a flu shot, you could walk right in and you could get a flu shot at 4 o'clock in the morning.
It's hard to argue with the convenience. Stores can usually bill insurers directly for the flu shot, which costs between $25 and $32. They offer several types of the vaccine, including nasal spray for kids and a special shot for seniors that creates a stronger immune response. For many customers, like Shelley Trofe and her son Drew, there's no copay. Trofe says she didn't even consider going to her doctor instead.
To be frankly honest, Walgreens is easier. Since this is 1 mile from my house and the clinic is 20 minutes from my house, this is where I come.
Warm up the syringe a little bit.
Pharmacy flu shots really started taking off during the H1N1 panic in 2009, when drugstores and supermarkets became a popular place to get vaccinated. And while most Americans still get their flu shot at the doctor's office, 20% went to a pharmacy last year instead. The stores see the vaccine as an important area of growth.
Everyone is trying to drive customers into their store to get their flu vaccine and then hopefully build customer loyalty and get them to buy other things in the store.
That's Edith Rosato of the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. She says flu shots are an opportunity for pharmacies and the public.
Certainly, with the shortage of primary care physicians and other healthcare professionals, we do see the role of the pharmacist as really taking on more responsibility in the healthcare delivery system.
Doctors don't seem to be pushing back about the safety of pharmacists giving the flu vaccine. Some are even grateful to give up a service that tends to take a lot of staff time, but isn't particularly lucrative. But pediatrician and University of Michigan professor Matt Davis has some concerns, especially for patients who only go to the doctor once a year to get their flu shot.
The main concern about pharmacy-based vaccination is that it might somehow discourage patients from otherwise following up with their doctors.
He also advises people with chronic illnesses to stick with their doctor so they can be tracked as carefully and consistently as possible. And as for the uninsured, Davis suggests they head to the county health clinic instead, where the flu shot might even be free. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Gold.
For some analysis, let's go to NPR's Cokie Roberts, who joined us most Monday mornings. Good morning.
Hi, Renee. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back. President Obama has been going around the country, as we've just heard, revving up crowds saying pass this bill. But as David just pointed out, there is some resistance to the bill within the president's own Democratic Party. How serious is the opposition among Democrats?
Well, it was serious enough that the situation played out last week in the Senate that could be very damaging for the president's program from here on out. The Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, in an effort to embarrass Democrats, brought up the jobs bill, the original jobs bill, as an amendment to another piece of legislation. But rather than have an embarrassing vote on that, the majority leader, Harry Reid, invoked what's been called the nuclear option, which is basically he used parliamentary tactics to change the rules of the Senate by a simple majority instead of that 60 supermajority vote that's usually needed to do anything in the Senate. It's a very dangerous precedent, and particularly for the Democrats, as they could easily find themselves in the minority after next year's election. And it's, you know, it's something that will be very, very contentious inside the Senate to do this kind of rules change in a heavy-handed fashion. And it really just shows that the problem, how big the problem is that the president has in getting his programs through the one House of Congress that is democratically controlled. And it raises the question of why he would send up a bill that the Democrats don't support without having, you know, checked it out with them ahead of time.
Well, in some ways, though, that jobs bill could be seen as the one of the least of the president's problems. Both he and the vice president have given interviews in recent days, and they made it clear that they think they are the underdogs in the next election.
Well, of course, they are. So they're sort of stating the truth. But in the last ABC poll, 40% said they strongly disapproved of the job the president's doing. And that's understandable given, you know, the economic situation. But the president gave an interview saying people are not better off than they were 4 years ago. Now, he was nuanced in that answer, but the sound bite is there to be used against him in the coming campaign. But I think more important is his sort of general gloominess, which can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, we saw this in 1980, where everybody was kind of feeling down about the economy and down about the country, and President Carter seemed to be down about everything. And Ronald Reagan came in and said, you know, it's wake up. It's a great country. And, you know, it's full of optimism and full of a sense of can do. And I think that that spirit is something that Americans respond to. And I think that that's what, you know, what the Republicans' big hope is in this election is to bring that spirit about.
Well, do you see a Ronald Reagan personality in this year's Republican lineup?
Well, no. At the moment, the flavor of the week is Herman Cain, but he doesn't really have a real campaign going.
Although he's pretty optimistic.
He's very optimistic.
He is an optimistic
and he's
guy.
and he totally gets that aspect of the American response to politicians. But what he doesn't have is any money or any staff. Look, the Republican contest has been and remains Romney versus non-Romney. And the non-Romney person keeps changing. Rick Perry's pastor aroused some controversy this weekend, the pastor who introduced him at the Values Voters Summit, saying that Mormons aren't Christians, that they're a cult. Then Rick Perry and all the other candidates sort of walk back from that one. And Perry specifically said, I don't think they're a cult. But that's going to be an issue in this campaign. But that big question of optimism is one that the Republicans can really capitalize on.
Cokie, thanks very much. NPR's Cokie Roberts. Now a story of a piece of art made whole again. The marble head and upper torso of a Roman sculpture was rejoined with its lower half at a ceremony in a Turkish museum this weekend.
The reunion took almost 20 years of negotiating. The upper part of the 1,800-year-old mythological figure Hercules had been on display in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. Turkish art historians claimed it was taken illegally from an archaeological site in Turkey in 1980, and scientific testing confirmed the two pieces were part of the same sculpture.
Last month, the Boston Museum signed an agreement transferring ownership of the bust, and Turkey's prime minister took the ancient treasure with him on a flight home after a visit to the U.S. The marble masterpiece is known in English as the Weary Hercules. Now that he's been patched up, perhaps he'll regain some of his fabled strength.
Imagine for a moment that we turned a national park into a do-it-yourself proposition. Imagine the U.S. government told people who live around Yellowstone, say, all those bears and wolves are now yours to take care of, and for doing that, you get to keep the money from tourists who come to see those animals. can sound radical, but that's essentially what the government of Namibia is doing right now. And as a result, wildlife numbers are rising there, unlike much of Africa. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, rural Namibians and international conservationists are embracing the idea, but living with wildlife isn't easy.
I'm on the road with Elias Neftali. Neftali used to shoot wild animals as a farmhand. Now he protects them. That can be scary.
Have you ever had an encounter with an elephant or a lion?
Oh my God.
Yep.
Neftali says he and other wildlife guards once were sleeping in a bungalow in the bush.
Somebody was screaming. When I opened my eyes, it was this elephant. He was so big.
Everyone froze.
The things that you see in movies, that we can hear him breathing so heavy, like very angry.
The elephant paused, then turned to the next building.
He threw off that roof completely, and then he went.
Now, Neftali helps manage wildlife for Namibia's Ministry of Environment and Tourism. Today, he's driving members of a communal conservancy out to count their wildlife. The conservancies are like village councils, with rural members who elect their own managers. The government created communal conservancies in 1996 to solve a problem. For decades, under the apartheid government, rural Namibians had little more than desert homesteads. Wildlife belonged to government. Usually it was fenced off in a park. Poaching was rampant. After Namibia won independence from South Africa in 1990, a new idea flourished. If rural people manage and profit from wildlife, they won't kill it off. Now, every year, the conservancies send teams in trucks out into the bush to count their assets, animals. Neftali maneuvers a pickup truck between boulders in a dry riverbed as his spotters stand in back. An animal with long, straight horns runs through the tall grass. It's an oryx, a big antelope.
How many oryx did you see?
Only one. You see one oryx.
A local wildlife tracker teaches me how to say oryx in Nama, the local Klik language.
One. Sweep. Sweep. Yeah.
A group of baboons climbs high on a cliff. Springbok antelope leap in fast retreat. In some cases, we don't see the animal, only the mess it made. Like a big tree that looks as if it's been hit by lightning.
No, it's the work of the elephant. It's an elephant that have broken the branches, testing their strength, I guess.
This is the Huab Conservancy. It covers an area a little bigger than Houston and has only 5,000 inhabitants. It's fairly new and is not making money. There aren't a lot of animals here or a tourist lodge, and tourist lodges are the big money spinners. Other conservancies are doing better, though, like Kawati Hoas, just north of Huab. The conservancy owns the Grootberg Lodge at the edge of a mountain valley that looks almost like Mars. Black rhinos and lions thrive there, and tourists love it. Hilga Howises has run the conservancy for 8 years.
I'm a brave woman. I'm not afraid to talk. I'm not afraid even to the minister. I'm afraid of lion and elephant. I don't want to come close to them.
Keeping up the numbers of charismatic animals draws not only tourists, but hunters. Trophy hunting is the second highest source of income for the conservancies. They charge up to $15,000 to shoot a lion. $15,000 is three times the average annual income in Namibia and way more than what farmers make. And people can shoot game, like antelope, for meat.
Every 2 years, we are doing community hunting, whereby we give meat to each household.
Rural Namibians have few options, and they hold high expectations for the conservancies. John Kasuona is a farmer, the son of a former poacher, and now a conservationist. He co-directs IRDNC, the nonprofit agency that guides the conservancies.
People are very desperate. Everybody wants to make sure that they're getting the most out of this whole cake. And people are not very patient.
It takes a long time for uneducated farmers to learn how to run tourist lodges or manage the flow of cash. But Kasuona says there are other measures of success. New jobs and local control.
The broader picture is that the understanding of having this to be run without any outside interference, to me, is the key.
Albert Guriseb got a job at Kawati Hoas, first as a hunting guide and then doing damage control. Today he's traveling by donkey cart to find and pay farmers who've lost livestock to predators. This is the price of success.
When the conservancy start, the number of the predators increase.
because we are looking after them.
And how did people's feelings about the predators change?
They say they are not happy about the increasing of the predators.
Gurus have visits a one-room farmhouse on a dusty hill. Goats shuffle behind a wire fence. Katrina Katutumosa farms here with her daughter. She says recently a cheetah ate three of her goats. She saw the whole thing. She complains that the conservancy doesn't pay the full market value of her goats. Even if they did, having cheetahs around isn't worth it, she says. Guruseb smiles. He tells me that outside the conservancies, farmers get nothing when a predator kills livestock. Farther down a dirt road, I meet Michael Guiseb at his uncle's farm. A few days before, an elephant came through here and almost destroyed his cistern, a concrete tank 15 feet high. Guiseb says he heard the elephant before he saw it.
Even the stomach of the elephant makes some noise. It's making that sort of noise. If the elephant makes that noise, then you can hear it. Something is wrong here.
Elephants hunt water, so the conservancy is building water wells away from farms just for elephants. Guiseb, who wants to become a conservationist himself, says that's good. People are learning.
Some people want to kill the elephants, but the good way is let's conserve it. Bringing them very closer to the wildlife, to the elephants, will change this attitude of the people.
Most conservancy members I talk to say profiting from wildlife is better than when the white apartheid government owned it all. And the numbers for rare species like rhinoceros and game species like springbok are up. Poaching is way down. The conservancies earn about $7 million annually. John Casuona acknowledges a lot of that money goes to pay for killed livestock. But he says in Africa, wildlife is worth more than these costs.
We have got an open landscape, still not occupied by human beings. If we don't look after the resources, I don't know how Africa is to support its citizens.
After 15 years, communal conservancies are still an experiment. But now, wildlife managers from the rest of Africa, Asia, and even the U.S. are coming here to learn how the Namibians do it. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And tomorrow, Christopher will tell us about another controversial part of Namibia's program, shooting wildlife. This is NPR News.
The Nobel Prize for Economics was awarded today to two Americans, Christopher Sims of Princeton University and Thomas Sargent of New York University. The two were cited for their pioneering research into the relationship between government and economic activity. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports now, their work shed new light on how policy decisions can and can't stimulate growth.
The phone rang before dawn at Christopher Simmons' house this morning. At first, he and his wife figured it was a prank call and went back to sleep. But Sims said a few minutes later, it rang again.
Then they called, and Kathy said, well, if it is a prank, they're doing a pretty good Swedish accent.
Sims was told he will share the $1.5 million prize with his longtime colleague, Thomas Sargent. Both men studied together at Harvard and ended up on the faculty at the University of Minnesota. Now they're teaching a class together at Princeton. But Sims said they're not exactly collaborators.
I'm not so sure it's right to say we have worked together. It's more we have a series of continuing arguments, many of which are still going on. As I slowly persuade him of the error of his earlier positions.
But the two have focused on the same field of research over the years, and the Nobel Committee said their work has been complementary. Sims and Sargent were instrumental in developing new computer models that helped explain how the economy is affected by government and central bank policy. Robert Schiller of Yale says before they came along, economists used models to understand how the economy worked, but the models were often crude.
The way they represented how people behave didn't take account of the fact that people think. They're not as mechanical, as knee-jerk, as was assumed by the previous models.
For instance, economists long assumed that countries could stimulate growth by unleashing inflation. Wages would rise, people would spend more, and demand for goods and services would grow. But Schiller says at some point, people catch on to what's happening.
You know, eventually people will get used to realize that we're living in high inflation, and and they won't be stimulated by it anymore. It'll wear out.
And once people and businesses come to expect higher and higher prices, they do things to counteract it, like not spending as much or demanding higher wages, which can lead to unforeseen economic problems. Over the years, Sims and Sargent have looked into the ways that human expectations are affected by economic policy and vice versa, something that economic models traditionally missed. Here was Sargent at a press conference today.
We build models where people's expectations about what the government is going to do are really important in influencing events. And those expectations can't be just arbitrary because they depend on partly on what the government's going to do. And what the government's going to do partly depends on those expectations.
The Nobel Committee said the field of research pioneered by Sims and Sargent has been widely used by central bankers and government policymakers. It helps them understand the real impact of their decisions on economic growth, and that's especially relevant right now, at a time when governments and central banks all over the world are pondering ways to get their economies moving again. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. While some teens and tweens spent the summer babysitting or mowing lawns, a growing number spent long hours in front of a screen with their parents' blessing. From Hoover, Alabama, Gigi Duban reports on a new high-tech phenomenon. Very young mobile app developers.
One night this past summer, Ozair Patel and his parents were sitting around the dinner table. They were talking about the new school year and how Ozair could be more organized. Now, Ozair is a bright kid, but like a lot of 13-year-olds, he loses things. Handouts, notices, things like that. So by the first week of school, he'd built himself an iPhone app. He called it Barry Schoolmate, after his school, Barry Middle.
It has a school's calendar on it, so you can find what days you have school off, and you can email your teachers from your iPod and your iPhone.
Word spread about the app, and Ozair became a middle school rock star. In the hallways, kids patted him on the back. They gave him high fives. Most of them wanted to know how he did it, so they could build mobile apps too. In fact, the school district's chief technology officer was so impressed, he asked Ozair to make apps for other schools.
You agreed?
Yeah, I did.
Are they going to pay you?
A lot. I don't know if it's a lot, but they're all going to pay me.
A school system spokesman said they haven't yet nailed down how much he'll be paid, but they'll be sure to follow all child labor laws. Ozair is okay with this odd little arrangement.
So I'm working two jobs, being a student and working with them.
Isn't that kind of bizarre?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, but I'm getting paid, so.
Ozair is part of a growing trend of kids turned entrepreneur. For instance, the eighth grader who built Bubble Ball, an app that managed to knock Angry Birds out of the top app slot. It's been downloaded more than 9 million times. Many young developers are hoping to nail the next big hit and make some money. Say you build an app for an iPhone or iPad. You charge 99 cents per download. Then, if 1,000 people buy it, that's $700 after Apple's 30% cut. Free apps make money through ads.
I'm T-Pain, you know me, I'm big music, nappy boy.
But not all kids do this to get rich. They want to build something fun, like this.
I'll take it home with me.
Got money in
It's a musical app that changes your voice. Stanford professor Ge Wang created it and other popular musical apps. He says more kids are learning to build apps now because, well, they can.
It's really not that hard. All the tools are there and they don't cost a lot of money.
Wang says platforms like Apple's online app store have made it easier to bring a product to consumers. And he adds, lots of kids thrive on exploring uncharted territory and taking risks, which makes them fearless entrepreneurs.
Overall, the market is absolutely booming at the moment.
Carolina Milanese analyzes the app industry. Mobile app sales are expected to double next year to $17 million. And Milanese says tech-savvy kids are poised to move in on those profits.
These devices are used in school. They're part of their everyday life, and it's both play and work for them.
And for all those kids at Barry Middle School who wanted a piece of the action, Ozair started an app club. For NPR News in Hoover, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban.